From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll explore some lessons Milwaukee public schools can learn from other urban school districts. Then we'll meet the sign painter behind local business signs like Ruby's Bagels.
Being from Milwaukee, I was exposed to these old signs on the buildings, and I was really curious as to how those signs got up there. And doing some digging around, you find out that it was done by a human being with a brush, and it was called sign painting.
We'll learn the history of Milwaukee's Enderis Park neighborhood and how it grew around the playfield at its center.
They referred to it as the park at 72nd and Chambers more often than anything else. So it didn't really seem to have an identity in terms of a name until it's renamed for Dorothy Enderis.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. A new report from the Wisconsin Policy Forum gives Milwaukee Public Schools a roadmap for a turnaround by taking lessons from other cities. The report examines similarly large and diverse school districts across the country and urges MPS to, quote, raise the bar. Researchers hope lessons learned in cities like Chicago and Washington, D.C. can help guide changes in Milwaukee. The goals include hiring and keeping teachers, fighting student poverty, and boosting quality school leadership. It also compares Milwaukee with the school district that serves children of Department of Defense employees because it has a similar level of student mobility. That's the number of students changing schools. WUWM education reporter Catherine Kokel spoke with Wisconsin Policy Forum Executive Director Jason Stein about the report. Stein begins by explaining why MPS is in a moment of transition.
The district does have a new superintendent who just recently started. There has been some change in other positions, like the district's chief financial officer. You know, the district had some challenges in reporting its financials and took some hits from the state in terms of state aid last year. And then in recent weeks and months has been coping with the finding of lead in its schools, which is not surprising, but also, you know, a failure to take some basic steps in some cases to remediate that lead or contain the damage it posed to or danger it posed to staff and students. So, you know, plus, you know, the ongoing challenges of the district's financing, decline in enrollment, and challenges in testing support. So there's a number of potential challenges for the district right now, but as well with some of the change in leadership and renewed scrutiny, some opportunity to, you know, achieve and make improvements for the community.
This report compared Milwaukee to other metro urban areas, and I just want to take this moment to list them. Those urban areas were Denver, Colorado, Miami-Dade County in Florida, Boston, Massachusetts, Charlotte-Mecklenburg County in North Carolina, as well as Chicago Public Schools and the Department of Defense. How do Milwaukee public schools compare to the achievement and the resourcing of schools in those areas?
They face at least some of the same challenges as Milwaukee, whether that's, you know, low-income students, many students of color, students with disabilities, students who don't speak English as their first language, or, you know, in the case of the Department of Defense, I think it's a good example of one of the big challenges in Milwaukee is high student mobility, students bouncing from school to school. You know, that's a challenge where with the Department of Defense, with children on military bases, also faced. So we tried to pick some peers that at least could inform best practices for an urban district like Milwaukee.
And so what takeaways are there from these large other school districts? What can Milwaukee learn from them?
You know, what we tried to focus on was some of the things that had gone well in these communities. Some of the options or the recommendations that we put forward, including, you know, leading boldly, looking at ways to take on difficult challenges, whether that is how educators are evaluated, whether that is and compensated, whether that's accountability measures for schools, whether that's, you know, in some cases, closures of schools. We looked at also how data can be used, how districts can try over time to focus on a few high impact levers to make change. So Chicago found that their high school graduation rates were really impacted by students failing to pass Algebra 1 and made a big push to help students over that hump and boost graduation rates in that way. And you know, another examples, just to give one final thing, is the teacher feedback and evaluation system that was set up in DC to incentivize the best teachers to work at the neediest schools. And then the way Chicago, you know, not just within the district, but also with academics at the great higher ed institutions in the Chicago area, as well as philanthropic nonprofits, to try to, you know, bring as many resources and insight as possible into the district and into classrooms to improve outcome.
There are two pieces, and you touched on one just a moment ago, but two pieces of data that the report suggests MPS really drilled down on to understand how student achievement can be improved. And those pieces are student absenteeism, which the report notes has skyrocketed in Milwaukee in the years since the pandemic, as well as student mobility, which the report defines as students moving from school to school. How do those two pieces impact a student's ability to achieve within MPS?
Absolutely. So I'm really glad that you drilled down to those two, because those are two of the most important factors, I think, right in the city of Milwaukee right now. One, student absenteeism has always been a problem, even going back to before the pandemic, but it just was the problem was just supercharged during the pandemic. You know, that's defined as students who are chronically absent miss more than 10% of school days. In MPS, that number, it's come down a little bit since the height of the pandemic, but it's still close to, you know, one in two students, which is, you know, very high. And then we also see this student mobility, where students, whether it's because of evictions, you know, instability within families, or just because of all the education options, traditional public, independent charter, and private voucher schools that exist in Milwaukee, we have students bouncing from school to school. And if you sort of do a thought experiment in your head and imagine that you're running a really good school, you're doing everything right as the principal and teachers, but you're only getting that student for 5 months, let's say in the second grade, and then they're going on to another school district. You know, think about how much positive impact are you going to be able to make for that student before they move on to another school. And I think everyone would recognize that it's not very much. So, you know, to the extent that we feel like school has a value, the first step is getting the student to school and keeping them there in a kind of a stable situation. And that's why those two metrics are so important.
Those two metrics kind of go hand in hand too, right? A student coming to school and then a student staying in that school. One of the takeaways of this report is that there is no silver bullet, right? There's not one thing that MPS and its new leadership can do to drastically solve all of these problems overnight, right? But I'm still going to put you in the hot seat and ask what you think the most important takeaway is for the leadership of MPS to start this turnaround and maintain this turnaround.
You know, so I to go back to our earlier point, I do think the most important thing for school to succeed is the students have got to be in school, physically located there, and they got to stick with the school at least long enough to give that school a chance to make a positive impact. So the mobility and student absenteeism is just paramount. You know, the other, you know, big thing that is paramount is student safety, whether that's the physical environment, you know, or the lead paint issue. Whether that's, you know, crime or other issues, you know, parents have got to feel like their students are safe in school, or that they won't keep them there and there won't be the financial stability that the schools need to succeed over time. You know, in terms of other issues, having a, you know, high standards, having adequate resources to achieve those standards, having solid data that is transparent and available, not just to principals and teachers, but also to the public and parents, having collaboration across different school sectors, because it is difficult to have sort of accountability and an overall vision for education in Milwaukee when there are so many different actors. But there are opportunities, I think, for the different types of schools to collaborate, whether that's in lobbying for funding for special education from the legislature, or perhaps coming up with a common enrollment approach across different types of schools. And then lastly, the thing that I would point to is making sure that the city and region and state as a whole is recruiting, developing, and retaining talented teachers and principals and other school professionals, because education is a very labor-intensive activity, and if you don't have quality people doing it, it's just not reasonable to think you're going to get quality results.
When I interviewed Dr. Brenda Caselius, who is MPS's new superintendent, she said something like, education has always been a human resources field, right? That our people need to be the ones to do this work, and you can't do it without all of the people who exist from all corners of a school. So you put a pretty fine point on that as well.
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at the operating budget of a school in Wisconsin, something like 80% of the operating budget, the general fund and the special education fund, is going to go to staff compensation, salaries and benefits. So if that money is not being spent efficiently, effectively, and on the best quality people, you can just see from a financial standpoint, you're not going to get the best results.
Jason Stein is the executive director of the Wisconsin Policy Forum. He spoke with WUWM education reporter Catherine Kokel. And did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. Coming up, we'll learn about the history of Milwaukee's Enduris Park and the woman it's named after. But first, a local artist who makes handmade signs tells us all about his craft. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. You're likely familiar with the painted logos of businesses like Ruby's Bagels or murals like El Palatero in Walker's Point, which shows an ice cream cart vendor. But do you know the artist behind them? Michael Cerda is a sign painter, music producer, and owner of Cerda Design Company. He joins Lake Effect's Excret Nunez to talk about how Milwaukee inspires and motivates his art.
Michael, your signs are all over the city, but a lot of people might not be familiar with you as the artist behind them. I'm curious how you got inspired to become a graphic designer and sign painter.
Well, it all started as a kid. I grew up drawing, always loved art, and as I got older, I struggled finding ways to make money off of it, because just living as an adult and in the real world, you need to make money along with doing what you love. So I tried a bunch of different stuff. I did airbrushing at the mall. I did logos for friends and family. Drew pictures as a when I was younger for like a few quarters or like a few bucks here and there, just finding any ways to have it make sense. And then I found graphic design being like a good middle ground, or like a good balance between like doing what I like and then something that could be considered like a real job. So I dove headfirst into that by going to METC, graduated after 2 years with my associates in graphic design, and used that to land work. And then I still loved doing design, but I was curious about other ways that I could pursue art. And then I found sign painting because of typography and like layout design, and all that just kind of worked together. And being from Milwaukee, I was exposed to these old signs on the buildings that are like super faded. They're called go signs. And I was really curious as to how those signs got up there. And doing some digging around, you find out that it was done by a human being with a brush. And it was called sign painting. So I started to do my research, and to my surprise, there wasn't a ton of tutorials online of how to do like this really old school thing. So I just kind of relied on trial and error, bought brushes, paint, and used the knowledge that I had at the moment to just kind of teach myself how to become a sign painter. And over the course of the year of learning, I met some OGs. There's a sign painter named Jeff Williams that has done a ton of work here in the city that I took a class with him for a little bit. Mm. And other friends that had similar interests that we just kind of shared tips and tricks and stuff. And I just fell into sign painting and became obsessed and made it my full-time or kind of like my full-time job along with my graphic design and my music production work.
I see a lot of like creativity, but a lot of history and research and mentorship too. Mm-hmm. That's kind of crafted.
It's really important.
Yeah. Who you are right now.
Absolutely.
To follow up with that, is there someone or something that sparked that creativity or interest in becoming an artist?
Yeah. There's a few things that are really important. I think my environment as a kid really affected me choosing art. My parents are awesome. They really allowed me to explore that side of my brain a little bit. But I have like a memory of my dad would be on the phone talking to my grandparents back in Mexico, and he would sit me on his lap as he was on the phone, and he'd be doodling on a napkin. I mean, it was always like the side profile of a man's head. And I would just see it and I'll be like, how is he doing that with like this pen? Like, I'm a little kid and I'm just watching him draw this head. And that just like sparked my curiosity of like, I want to do that. So taking pen to paper and just started drawing myself, and just I haven't stopped since. But again, going back to the environment that they provided for me was just like, they encouraged me to pursue art. Obviously, they might have had some pushback when I got older as far as like, are you sure you want to do this? Like, you can't make that much money. But that's just them being good parents. You know, they wanted the best for me. But I had to be a little bit of a stubborn individual to be like, shh, I got this. I'm gonna try this. So yeah, I think just a mixture of seeing my dad draw for the first time and then having that safe environment to really pursue it.
That's really beautiful and amazing that you had that supportive environment. Yeah. Something that I notice about your work is your attention to detail with typography. Mm-hmm. When I see it, I notice it's very sleek and it has a lot of character. Where do you get your inspiration from for letters?
As of late, inspiration comes from just driving around. I love cruising around Milwaukee and documenting the signs that I see. Like, if you go through my camera roll on my phone, the majority of it is literally either screenshots that I find on Instagram or photos that I take of old signs. I think there's a lot to be learned from like past work. A lot of it is just kind of like repurposing what already works and just kind of adding my own style on top. I think within design and typography and stuff, there are certain rules you have to follow for things to look good, but there is still a lot of room to be creative with the way you dress up letters. Inspiration also comes from my graffiti background. As a teenager, I did graffiti. Back then, I didn't know what I was really doing. I just thought it was like, you know, hip hop, graffiti. It was like, I was obsessed with it, right? But I was working with letters. It's essentially typography and like design and layout, just in a really like rough, raw way. I was kind of training myself on how to work with letters and style, you know, like developing a style. With graffiti, it's all about how do you dress up the letter A, the B, C to be your own unique thing. And being able to establish that really early helped me now as a professional to explore different styles and ways of letter treatment to come up with unique stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. So some businesses that you've designed for include Ruby's Bagels, Ebb and Flow in River West, Lilliput Records, and Pete's Pops. Why do you think so many local businesses ask you to paint their signs?
To be honest, like, I'm going to take a wild guess. I mean, for the Ruby's Bagels, she is my beautiful girlfriend, and my role in the business is to help with the design and the signs. And she's given me the amazing opportunity to kind of like be a part of like her brand, to help create her brand. And a big part of it is the hand-painted signs. And I think she appreciates like the handmade element of my work. You know, she makes the hand-rolled bagels, so the hand-painted signs, it just kind of works really well. Mm-hmm. As far as my other clients, I think they just, again, appreciate like the human touch, where if you were to go with like a vinyl sign, as clean and perfect as it is, there's not much story there. There's more story with a hand-painted sign because it's not perfect. If you go up close to it, you'll notice that the lines aren't perfectly straight. The corners aren't perfectly sharp. I try to get them as sharp as possible, but there's just like that human touch that you can't really replicate with vinyl. And also too, like when you go to any small business, you go because you know you're doing your part to help their business and you're getting something unique in return. And the same can be said with the hand-painted sign. You're helping my small business and you're helping me kind of keep moving forward. And I'm giving you this unique thing that's a one of one that can't be replicated. It's an honor really to be able to be a part of like their journey and like their story. When I first started sign painting, that part didn't really click yet. But the more signs I did, I'm realizing like, wow, I'm being given a huge responsibility because the sign is usually the first thing that they're going to see when they walk up to the business, you know, so it's got to look good. And they're putting a lot of trust in me. And I take that very serious.
Yeah. And on top of designing and painting signs for businesses, you've also painted a few murals throughout the city.
Yep.
Your most recent mural was the El Paletero mural in Walker's Point. How did that opportunity come up and what does the paletero symbolize for you?
So that came up through, I was connected with Izzy Lugo from, he works with the Brewers. I was connected to him through a really good friend of mine, Jesus Gonzalez, which is the owner of Socolo Food Truck Park. Mm. And we were hanging out and he told me like, hey, there's an opportunity to work with the Brewers through Izzy. They're looking to do some murals. And I jumped on it right away. I reached out, we connected, we had a meeting. I had an idea that I pitched of like, there's this idea that I had way before the Brewer thing of painting a paletero. First of all, I love the meaning behind it, the visual element, like the look, maybe because it taps into like my childhood too. But I just wanted to do like a portrait style painting of a paletero. Just never got around to doing it, never found the perfect location for it. So this Brewer thing came up and it was the perfect opportunity to kind of like tie in everything about my childhood and like this story and this idea into one mural. And I feel like Walker's Point is like the perfect neighborhood for it. But I'd say the meaning and the message behind it is just to kind of highlight hardworking immigrants, kind of like the unsung heroes of our community. You know, we see them walking by and some of us will stop. I feel like I'm the one to stop, buy a paleta and just keep it moving. Other people don't really pay attention, you know. But the thing is, these people are out there day in, day out. They're working, they're grinding, even when it's raining. So I know there's a guy out there that'll be out there when it's still really cold. But they're out there just grinding, working. That's a really strong message, right? And I think the combination of the Brewers logo that says Milwaukee with the paletero sitting on top of it just, to me, felt like the perfect combination, you know? If you go up to the mural, I don't know how tall it is, but I want to say it's probably the tallest paletero mural. And being able to stand next to it and to look up, you know, it makes it feel really powerful. And, you know, I feel like it demands respect, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. It is really powerful.
Yeah, thank you.
So your creativity also stems beyond painting. You're also a Grammy Award-winning music producer. One of your beats was picked up by Kanye West for his Jesus is King LP. Can you tell me how this opportunity came up for you?
Yeah, I've been doing music since I was a teenager, just making beats in my bedroom. And then a few years later, I want to say when I was like 25, 26, I transitioned into kind of like composing music. Because prior to that, I was sampling. Mm-hmm. So I was buying records. If anyone's familiar with the art of sampling within hip hop, you know, they take a record and they essentially chop up the audio to take certain pieces of that music to create a new composition by essentially adding drums on top and it turns into a beat. A lot of your favorite rap songs, they're probably sampled from records. So I saw that there was a demand for original compositions and samples that producers and artists could use so they could clear it better. Let's say a big artist uses a record, they essentially have to clear it with the artist. And some of those fees can be kind of ridiculous, like mm-hmm. really expensive. So I started composing my own original samples. So learning how to play the piano, guitar, and creating these compositions that sound like pieces of music that you would find on a record, but they're made by me. And if it gets used, I would provide, and I do provide, a really smooth process to get it cleared. Sometimes it's just a really simple fee and I get a producer credit and I get my share on publishing. It's just a much smoother, faster way to get things going. I was doing that and I was working on some original music, I want to say 2018, 2019. And I got approached by this producer named Boogs the Beast out of Chicago, who works really closely with Kanye West. And I sent him a folder of some of my latest stuff that I was working on. He had asked for, it's called a pack. Like you send a pack and it usually means send me whatever you're working on right now. Mm. A few weeks went by And he messages me and he says, can you hold a certain piece of music for me? Because I think Kanye is going to use it. I told this story a million times already, but it's like when he told me that, I remember feeling like, not that he was lying, but it felt like too good to be true.
Yeah.
So I didn't get too excited.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, okay, I'll hold it. And then another few days goes by. He calls me and says, hey, we have a song on Kanye's album, Jesus is King. So please hold this. It's going to be used. And I think at that moment, it started to really sink in, like, I'm really about to be on Kanye's album. But where it really kind of like hit home and felt real was obviously when the song came out, the album came out, which was 2019 in October. And playing it on Spotify for the first time, it was a surreal moment seeing my name in the credits, hearing the sample being used by Kanye, and it completely changed my life and like the trajectory of my career, because I went from just a producer trying to figure out what he was going to do with his career living in Milwaukee to now a professional like industry producer living in Milwaukee still, but with Kanye West as a credit. And then time goes by, and then he gets nominated for a Grammy for Top Contemporary Christian Album, and we end up winning. So going from just a producer now to Grammy award-winning producer within a year, very surreal, but super-duper grateful. And it's just kind of like, it gave me the confidence I needed to keep pursuing music. And since then, I've been able to work with a ton of cool artists.
Yeah, and like you said, you've done it all from Milwaukee. And I feel like I'm seeing this like pattern that you have this like really strong creative drive and you find ways to like collaborate with others to make it work.
Yeah. Teamwork makes the dream work. And I 100% believe that because I wouldn't be able to do it alone. I needed to learn from Jeff Williams and my homie Chris Walker to learn how to sign paint. I needed Boogs the Beast and my guy Matthew who introduced me to Boogs in order to connect those dots to work with Kanye. I need people. I need to build this network, this community in order to become successful.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. It all goes back to community.
Yeah.
So we're nearing towards the end of our conversation, but I kind of would like to reflect on everything we've talked about. What do you think is special about designing and painting for a city like Milwaukee?
Oh, it's special. I feel like it's like untapped potential here. I feel like a lot of people that are creatives, they tend to want to leave to go to other big cities to pursue art, music, and all that. But I think staying here was really important because there's a lot of stories to be told here yet. So the untapped potential. I love the fact that I get to do my work here because it's just kind of building up this city to be a creative hub. You know, I want there to be cool hand-painted signs on all the businesses and murals everywhere. And I want to be able to say, like, yeah, I'm working with big artists and going for my second Grammy, still living in Milwaukee. So to me, that's really important.
Well, Milwaukee is super lucky to have you.
Thank you.
Michael, thanks so much for speaking with me today. And it was really great to learn more about your work.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the time.
Michael Cerda is a sign painter, Grammy award-winning music producer, and owner of Cerda Design Company. He spoke with Lake Effect's Excret Nunez. We've got a new season of Bubbler Talk going, and we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. Coming up later in the show, we'll learn about Midwest Sad, a bakery in Milwaukee. But first, we'll learn about the history of Enderis Playfield and how the Enderis Park neighborhood was shaped around it. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. During work hours, we make a living. During leisure hours, we make a life. That is the quote most associated with Dorothy Enderis, the second and arguably most influential leader of the Milwaukee Recreation Department. Under Enderis' guidance, Milwaukee became a model for playground and social center programs in the nation. Enderis Playfield in the Enderis Park neighborhood is named in her honor. Bobby Tanzillo, senior editor and writer for On Milwaukee, wrote an extensive article on the history of Enderis Playfield. And he lives in the Enderis Park neighborhood. He joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to share more about the history of Dorothy Enderis and the park and neighborhood named in her honor.
So we're talking about the Enderis Park neighborhood, and the park is a central focal point to this whole community. But let's talk about it before it became this. What was the land before it was the playfield that's there today?
So this neighborhood was farmland. It was the town of Wauwatosa, not to be confused with the city or village of Wauwatosa. There was lots of little Wauwatosas. But this was the town of Wauwatosa, which was basically rural. And the land that the park sits on was a farm that was owned by a guy named Erastus. That's a name you don't hear much anymore, Erastus Smith. And actually, you know, if you go slightly northwest of the park, there's an intersection of Burleigh and Lisbon. And there's like a tavern there and some gas stations and a few other things. But that was originally called Smithville. So there was actually like a little Four Corners kind of thing there that was named after him. And he owned all of that farmland. And the neighborhood itself was originally sort of three separate farmsteads, but the park was on Erastus Smith's land. And then in the 20s, it started, you know, developers started to kind of move west of the city as demand grew, as population grew. And they platted out a whole neighborhood here, which was called Galecrest Park. And it's basically the street layout you see today, although there are some minor changes. But basically, if you look at the rendering of what they wanted it to look like, it's pretty much what it looks like now. And then they divided up into lots and started selling the lots. And by 1927, the city annexed it, and it became part of the city of Milwaukee. And right around that same time, the city also wanted part of the land to be a park. And they apparently bought a little bit of it at the time, because they start, you know, early documents show some of that land is already kind of as parkland, but they didn't actually end up buying the whole piece until 1931. And then the park happens sort of slowly, I think, initially, as the neighborhood grows. You know, they knew when they sort of set it aside as parkland, there wasn't really a neighborhood yet. It was just the plan of a neighborhood. But it was good they had the foresight to do that, you know, rather than just selling off all the lots and then we would have no place for parkland.
Exactly. So as the city purchased more land for this park, can you explain the transition of when it turned into a WPA project? Because that was definitely after the Great Depression. A lot of great programs and buildings, parks we see all around Milwaukee today are from the WPA.
Yeah, so the WPA was the Works Progress Administration, was set up to help employ some of the countless unemployed people during the Depression. So you get lots of 30s work that was done. And in the Milwaukee area, loads of them were parks. So if you go to Grant Park, you see the Seven Bridges and all that kind of thing. And in Enderis Park, that sort of shows itself in a 1938 service building that was built. And it's built of land and stone. And there's walls around part of the park that were built of land and stone that are from that era. There's some posts by the entrances that are from that era. There's an old horseshoe pit. You don't see too many people playing horseshoes anymore, but there's a horseshoe pit. And that has kind of a low wall that's also land and stone. And what's interesting is that that stone becomes sort of, you've seen the neighborhood, loads of land and stone houses in this neighborhood. And if you go further west into Cooper Park, into Mount Mary itself, most of the buildings are built with the land and stone, which came from Hartung. It's now called Hartung Park, but it was a quarry at the time that's just northwest of us, just beyond Copps Park. And actually the part of Enderis Park that I live in used to be the Hartung Farm. So the same family that owned that quarry. So there is really this big connection out here of all these sort of local things coming together. And so the WPA, one of the most beautiful things they built was actually, and I'm not sure what it was meant to be, it almost looks like a stage. It's got sort of a little covered walkway. It's got kind of a platform and some low walls. And it really just, it looks like it's meant to be a performance space, though I'm not entirely sure that's what it is.
So when it was a WPA project, was it still called Galecrest Park?
I think so. You usually, whenever I found references, I wrote a really long article about the park once. And whenever I found references to it in the neighborhood, I mean, in the newspapers, I'm sorry, they referred to it as the park at 72nd and Chambers more often than anything else. So it didn't really seem to have an identity in terms of a name until it's renamed for Dorothy Enderis.
Yeah, so let's get into Dorothy real quick here. She has a long-lasting legacy, and it's very fitting that this playfield is named after her. Who was Dorothy Enderes?
So Dorothy Enderes, she was born in Illinois, but as a baby, she came with her family to Milwaukee. So she went to the public schools here. She graduated from your alma mater, which was then called Westside High School, later West Division. And she then studied at the Normal School, which is a school for teachers, on Well Street. That's now the Rescue Mission. And she then took a job as a librarian, I think, at that same school. And then she was a school teacher for a little while. I think she taught fourth grade. And she got hired by the Recreation Division of Milwaukee Public Schools as an assistant to Harold Berg, who was sort of the kind of initially the leading light at the, he was the director, but he was really kind of a well-known proponent of this sort of lighted schoolhouse movement, which at the time, you know, in this early 20th century, there was this movement to open schools after hours so that the community would have a place to meet and to gather and to take classes. And it was very big for immigrants to take English language classes, for people to take, you know, sewing classes, cooking classes, lots of sports stuff for kids, that kind of thing. Really what we think of now as Milwaukee Rec, you know, that's the birth of Milwaukee Rec. And they still do the same sort of thing now. And they still do it in MPS schools. But he was really a big pioneer and proponent of that. And so Dorothy became his assistant. And when he took a job in Cleveland doing the same sort of thing, she had obviously shown her abilities and she was named to replace him, which in 1920 had to have been a pretty big deal.
Absolutely. And she continued to grow the outreach, the physical footprint of the programs, of places that people could go to. At the time, they were called social centers, but what we now know is Milwaukee Rec. So when was this park dedicated to her and in honor of her career and all that she's done for communities similar to the Enderes Park neighborhood?
Well, it happened in 1950. She retired in 1948. And in 1950 is when the city officially hands this park over to MPS for Milwaukee Rec to manage. And at that same ceremony is when they named it in her honor. And fortunately, she was alive and could be there for it and enjoy it. It didn't happen after she was gone.
And it's now known as a playfield. Is that the main difference? A park is by the county and a playfield is City of Milwaukee run through the Rec Division?
It's complicated, I think. Initially, playfields had a sort of very strict definition. They were a minimum amount of acres. They were aimed at kids who were a little older, 15 and up, and they had a lot of programming in them as well. You know, if you look at old Milwaukee Rec documents and stuff, you'll see that nearly all of the playfields had organized classes, organized sports teams, organized like after-school programming, organized summer programming. There's old pictures at Enderes Park of like kids track and field events and things like that, you know. And so they were, I think playfields were also just very much more programmed than parks. I think we think of, I mean, what you said is a pretty good sort of basic idea. We think of county parks as parks and city parks as playfields a little more, but that's also because the city playfields did for a long time have this kind of programming, and a park was more a place you just kind of went and hung out with your family, spread the blanket, had a picnic, you know, that kind of thing. And a playfield was where kids went and stayed off the streets, hopefully otherwise.
In your work on reading about the park, about Dorothy, what role do you see the park continuing to play today and the legacy that it's named after?
I think it really is a place that serves what is a much more diverse neighborhood than I think people might expect. If you just sort of drive through it, you might think, oh, it's all single family homes, but actually there are single family homes, there are some duplexes, there's quite a few multifamily rentals. So it's economically diverse, it's racially diverse, and everyone uses the park. I mean, if you walk through the park, there'll be like daycare groups on the weekends. There's like huge family picnics. There's all of these events we talked about going on in the park. Plus, if you just walk through in the morning, there's, you might see me jogging through it or walking my dog through it, but there's like tons of other people walking their dogs at the same time. There'll be people playing pickleball. It's amazing to walk past it on a nice summer day, especially on a weekend. And, you know, the pickleball courts are being used. There's kids in the wading pool. There'll be a softball game going on. If it's the evening on the softball field, there'll be a family having a picnic on one part. You know, there was a second building that was built in 1949, a field house that is also where Milwaukee Rec has a few classes in there, not a ton, but some. And it's where we all vote. So, you know, we all come together there to exercise that right together as a community. And it just, it feels like a neighborhood park. And it's appropriate that the neighborhood is named after the park, because I can't imagine what the neighborhood would be like without it, because we wouldn't have that same kind of, it's almost like a, you know, a European main square in a way.
Well, Bobby, thanks so much for joining me and sharing more about Enders Park.
Thanks, Audrey. Always happy to be on here.
Bobby Tanzillo is a senior editor and writer for On Milwaukee. He spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski in 2023. Milwaukee's Midwest Sad Bakery opened in 2024, serving up all kinds of snacks and sweets. The name refers to seasonal affective disorder and the way that nostalgic treats can lift your spirits. The small carryout bakery operates in a commissary kitchen near Cathedral Square Park. But recently, Midwest Sad owner Sam Sandrin announced plans to open a new location in Walker's Point. WUWM's Lena Tran spoke with Sandrin about how the bakery got started.
So I've been in the industry for 15, 16 years, and I started at a place that's now closed. It was called The Open Hearth, as a dishwasher, busser, human. And I was there for about a year, and then the owner made me cry because I was a 15-year-old host wearing a black tie, and I hated it. So I left. And then ever since then, I wanted to be in a place that didn't make me cry. So I've been trying to make that a goal in my life. I haven't succeeded yet because I do that to myself. Being a very young woman in the kitchen is, it's different now than it was back then. I remember getting called like jailbait when I was 17 and like just groping and being harassed and all these horrible things.
Do you feel like coming up with your own operation was like, like that's the culmination of your journey to create the culture that doesn't make you cry?
Yes. Ironically, even though it's called Midwest Sad, which SAD, like seasonal affective disorder, is where that name actually comes from, which is like everything that makes you feel better, whether it be food, whether it be community, whether it be your coworkers, whatever that is, I want to like encapsulate that completely into the brand of Midwest Sad.
More on like the work culture and what that means to you. Like, yeah. What is it that you're trying to build here that you feel like you hadn't been able to get in other places?
So a lot of people in the service industry kind of mask, and it's not necessarily intentional, but it's how we get through our day. It can be toxic positivity, which, I mean, it sounds silly being like, oh, being positive, like that's how everyone should live, but that's just not the reality of the situation. I mean, every single day we see different things happening in the world, and to act like they don't exist when you're at your job is impossible, especially with social media. So like being able to just be a person, and customers not always right, and trying to figure out the best way to like exist in this time and place. I want to make sure everyone's safe and open to be themselves, and they don't have to be happy. I don't expect people to come here and have their life be their job. Your job should be the least interesting thing about you. Like, you shouldn't revolve your life around that. I have so much passion for what I do, but at the end of the day, I want to live. I don't want to live to work. And I want everyone that works for me, with me, as a member of my team and community, to just be themselves without fear of retribution or having to exist in a way that they're not supposed to. We're not supposed to be like this. We're supposed to like be in a field of flowers, but it doesn't always work out that way. So it's easier to just be yourself than force it.
I love that. And I'm sure a lot of people in the service industry will like hearing that too. Okay, so Midwest Sad, you've said that it's about emo nostalgia. What does that mean to you?
So I turned 30 this year, so I'm not quite an elder millennial. I think I'm like on the cusp of it. So growing up, I remember going to like Warped Tour every year for like 10 years. And I remember going to the last one and going to shows at the Rave and all these other places, at the Miramar growing up, like all these very nostalgic kind of places for millennials, and specifically in like the Midwest community. Pop punk and all these different variations of music really helped expand my thinking and my life when I was growing up, especially in community, because there's a huge sense of community in music, especially locally in Milwaukee. So just kind of bringing those two things together of like, yeah, I'm sad, but I could also eat cake and be sad. So there's like a way to be and deal with it, but like eating it's just better. So my hope is to partner with like X-Ray Arcade and like go to music festivals and like offer everything I offer here for that kind of comfort, but at a festival.
Talk about some of the stuff that you are making, the array of treats that you have. What can people expect?
Right now, I just posted a new menu, and it's kind of like stuff that you can find at like a cookout on the 4th of July. So like potato salad and like the broccoli cauliflower bacon cheese salad and stuff like that. That's like, you're still filling up on food, but you're getting a better sense of wonder from it than just like, I'm going to have a tuna salad sandwich. It's like, no, let's make it fun instead of just being like depressed about your food, like enjoying it's half of the battle. So I'll be doing like more bougie stuff like French macarons, but then I'll also be doing like little succulent pots, which are really just dirt cups with piped succulents on them to make them cute.
Love that. Millennial dirt cake.
Yeah, exactly. Millennial dirt cake. That's exactly what it is. I have like an egg salad hoagie that's egg salad, chili oil, and shallots. But none of the portion sizes are huge, so it's like really good snacking sizes for like lunch or catering or big events like that. So kind of everything. And apparently people really love Fluffernutter everything, which I thought it was just a me thing, but I do realize it's the Midwest, so it's like a peanut butter cookie, and then I caramelize marshmallows, and it turns into like a nougaty, really rich, buttery cookie. Those always sell out almost immediately when I put them on the menu.
I've also seen you've done stuff like ambrosia and rock candy. There's this like deep sense of throwback and nostalgia in a lot of your stuff. Where does that come from?
So growing up, I remember walking through Milwaukee Public Museum every single Saturday with my dad because he always had to work. And he passed away during COVID, and it's kind of like an ode to him. I used to get so many different flavors of rock candy, and like I loved that place, the Milwaukee Public Museum. I guess they're bringing it back. I really hope so. But when I was at 3rd Street, I accidentally made rock candy, and I was like, what the hell am I doing? How did I do this? So then I just did it again, but I did it on purpose. And then the ambrosia is actually inspired by my old business partner who was like obsessed with it. She made these like licorice marshmallows, and I was like, wait a second, they have like these Tutti Frutti marshmallows that I grew up with, and they still have them. So just kind of bringing all these like little memories and people that were important or important in my life into the menu.
That is really sweet. Thank you for sharing. It's a beautiful way to remember your dad. Tell me about a recipe that you figured out, or, you know, something that you're really proud of.
What am I excited about?
Also, well, monkey bread, sorry.
Yeah, I was literally going to say monkey bread. That I'm actually really excited about, not just because you just mentioned it, but because I actually am excited about it. It's essentially like a white sandwich bread, like nothing crazy, but I proofed it for double the amount of time, and I added potato starch to make a like very light bite that essentially tastes like white sandwich bread, but way more buttery, way more light, a little more salty than your average one, and not sweet, it's savory instead. So I make pesto, make roasted garlic, and then I make chive butter, and I put that actually in the layers how you would with like cinnamon sugar, and then it just turns into this like toasted gooey deliciousness.
Whoa,
it's amazing. So then I just cut a huge one into like 4 or 5 and then give them some parmesan chive butter, and it's delicious.
Yum. My mom used to make monkey bread as like a Christmas morning thing, and that's what it makes me think of. And it's like such a special thing to, like, you talked about how memories from your childhood of certain things are like infused in here, and it's nice because I feel like people also have echoes of that when they're having these treats, and it means a lot.
Yeah, it's kind of, as a millennial, we kind of saw the whole entire world change. I mean, things are very different from, I remember being a very young child and remembering, like, sky's the limit. And then as a millennial now, it's just very different to see the horrors of, like, everyday life. So I think it's really important to, like, focus on the good things. And that's why I love baking and creating food so much, just because it's, you don't need to know the language, you don't need to know the culture, but you need to know why the food is special and why sharing it's special and, like, the community that goes with it. So it's a little bit different now looking back and seeing that I'm recreating things that were really centric to my childhood, and I want to share that with everybody so they also remember it in their way.
That was Sam Sandrin, the owner of the bakery Midwest Sad. She spoke with WUWM's Lena Tran last year. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Wisconsin has one of the worst vaccination rates for measles in the country. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll learn more about how the measles epidemic could impact the state as outbreaks draw closer to our borders. Thanks so much for joining us right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.